Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's March 13th, 2022, and welcome to episode 252 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, roller coasters, compression, I don't know. We'll see. So I'm Paul Hagstrom, near Boston. I am joined by two retro computing enthusiasts this week. The first of whom is Quinn Dunkey in Los Angeles. How are you?
Hello, I am outstanding.
Excellent. And the other is Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
I am Quinn Dunkey. That means outstanding.
It's just a thing people say. I don't know.
Yeah. It's kind of like coming up with your own nickname. I don't know. Yeah. People just call me that.
Everyone calls me T-Bone. I don't know. It's just a thing.
This is episode 252. We haven't talked about the weather, but I'm sure it'll get worked in here somehow. And so the plan had been that we would sort of track the years, starting with the year 1950 with episode 250 and kind of moving along that way. So we are at the year 1952. And so the topic is something, things related to 1952, I guess. The way I took that was that 1952 was the year that David Huffman published an article on a method for the construction of minimum redundancy codes, which is basically the beginning of the Huffman code compression scheme. So I was going on things having to do with compression, but so I'll talk more about that, I suppose, in a bit. But what thoughts did you guys have about 1952 related things?
1952 is always on my mind. I actually did have a thing though. Going back to UNIVAC, we talked about UNIVAC in the last episode. It was still a big deal in 1952, and another big deal for America in 1952 was the election. So it was Eisenhower versus Adlai Stevenson. And you may have heard of President Adlai Stevenson. Oh, wait, no, you haven't, because he lost. But the polls before that were predicting maybe a close race or probably a landslide for Stevenson. Adlai Stevenson was going to walk away with this. And that's what everybody – it was all the polls said that. It was just a lock. And – for the night of the election on CBC News.
Good evening, everyone. This is Walter Cronkite speaking to you from CBS Television Election Headquarters here in New York City.
Remington Rand contacted CBS and said, why not put our big honking electronic brain on TV and it can do some election results like live, and it'll predict the election, and you can do it live on TV, and that'll be cool, and it might help us sell a bunch of computers, and it'll be great for you. Everybody wins. So they said, great, let's do that. So the CBC News
CBS
that night, and we're going to have a link in the show notes to a part of the broadcast. There's a site, Today in Media History, and it has a UNIVAC, like you can see the TV, the actual broadcast at night, when they cut to the person at around 8:30 to say, here's what UNIVAC has to say for the early returns. Paul should at this point cut in that audio.
And now for perhaps a prediction on how this voting is going, what the vote that is in so far means, let's turn to that miracle of the modern age, the electronic brain UNIVAC, and Charles Collingwood.
This is the face of a UNIVAC. A UNIVAC is a fabulous electronic machine which we have borrowed to help us predict this election from the basis of the early returns as they come in. UNIVAC is going to try to predict the winner for us just as early as we can possibly get the returns in. Univac lives down in Philadelphia. He's one of a family of electronic brains made by the Eckert-Mockley division of Remington Rand. Univac, can you tell us what your prediction is now on the basis of the returns that we've had so far? Have you got a prediction for us, Univac? I don't know. I think that Univac is probably an honest machine, a good deal more honest than a lot of commentators who are working, and he doesn't think he's got enough to tell us anything about yet. But we'll be back with him later in the evening. Now back to Walter Cronkite.
So we've now heard that audio. So we're back from the audio. So in that audio, for those not listening live, you would have just heard them cut to the person saying, we've got this electronic brain, it's right behind me, it's exciting, and let's hear what Univac has to say. And then silence. Nothing. Looks a little confused. And I said, well, I guess Univac is, it's too early to predict and we'll come back later. But what happened behind the scenes is Univac said, landslide for Eisenhower. Eisenhower is going to get 450 or something. What was it? 438 of the, what, America's got this electoral college thing. It's ridiculous. But it predicted that Eisenhower would get 438 of the electoral college votes and Stevenson was going to get 93, which would be like the biggest landslide in decades, and completely the opposite of all polls. And so the news anchor, the news producer behind the scenes was just saying, no, cut it, don't say it because it's ridiculous. We're going to look like idiots. And if we put that prediction out on the air, it's probably maybe not illegal, but it is like as a journalist, it's just not appropriate to like put out something that's so clearly wrong. This computer has messed up ridiculously. So it's just dead air and they don't do it and they try to figure out what's going on. So meantime, they're running the program again, what's going on? And the computer's like, no, I'm telling you, man, Eisenhower wins this, wins it by a ton, and you're all wrong and you're too slow and you should have computers. Well, the computer was right, called it at 8:30, and it was way later in the evening, around 11:30 or so, when more polls are coming in, and it looks like the computer is right, that CBC went back on the air and kind of shyly said,
CBS.
Well, turns out there's a landslide, and we should just say that the Univac did predict this hours ago, but we wanted to check it, and that's why we didn't make it live on the air. And Remington Rand's like, this is not giving us the promotion we were hoping for. But it's like this whole thing that went on live that night behind the scenes that I find really interesting. So this was the first time a computer was trying to do these early poll results live. It totally nailed it. And then from the next election onward, all the networks all had computers and they all called it early because of this. This was the time where they said, computers are better than this than humans. Let's just have them do the call early on. So it was neat. So you can actually, the little audio you would have heard later is of the CBC.
CBS.
Just last minute saying, no, don't put that on. That's too ridiculous. A computer is just making things up. And it turns out it was true. So way to go, Univac. Score one for the computers. For the electronic brain.
So let's go down to Philadelphia and see whether we can get an explanation of what happened to Univac from Mr. Arthur Draper, who is the head of the new products division of Remington Rand's Laboratory for Advanced Research. Art, what happened there when we came out with that funny prediction?
Well, we had a lot of troubles tonight. Strangely enough, they were all human and not the machine. To start a prediction like this, you have to assume certain facts about past trends. When Univac made its first prediction with only 3 million votes in, it gave 5 states for Stevenson, 43 for Eisenhower, 93 electoral votes for Stevenson, 438 for Eisenhower. We just plain didn't believe it. So we asked Univac to forget a lot of the trend information that we had put into it, assuming that that was wrong. So Univac worked on a smaller margin of knowledge. This won't give a wrong answer, but it'll throw the odds to the extent that you saw. As more votes came in, the odds came back, and it was obviously evident that we should have had nerve enough to believe the machine in the first place. It was right. We were wrong. Next year, we'll believe it.
That's a good story. Cool. I had never heard any of that.
I only heard about that because the last couple of days I was looking into 1953 computer things.
Uh-huh.
52, 53, whatever this is. 52.
Like what was the Univac actually doing? Like, was it taking, I don't know, like poll numbers?
Well, see, that's interesting. So it was the program it was running was written by two people. They had approached like this mathematician, Max Woodbury, to but a person named Mockley and Woodbury did this. So Woodbury wanted Mockley to do it because the program they needed was something where you could take all the early polling results from their various constituencies and just like enter them in. And the computer ahead of time knew, they put a bunch of demographics in and said like, so this we think is a way to predict from early polling. If these couple of places go early, this is probably how this whole county is going to go or whatever. And that in past results they had analyzed to say these sorts of places in America kind of vote the same as these sorts of places in America. So when the early things close on the East Coast, we can predict this bit on the West Coast and all the kind of stuff they do today. And they just kind of made that up on their own. But none of this programming was done at Remington Rand or at CBC.
CBS.
Because Mockley had been blacklisted as a pro-communist because of the stupid thing going on in the 1950s where they're like, oh, hey, you're not right-wing enough for us. We might throw you in jail unless you tell us other people that are communists.
I invited them to give information of wrongdoing, graft, corruption, communism. I am continuing to get that information.
And so we've been blacklisted. So all this had to get done at Mockley's home, and Remington Rand just said, oh, we just have this program, but we don't want to talk about where it came from. So it's like all these scandals behind the scene in this program thing. It's like the whole thing was fascinating reading about this last week. So a commie wrote a program. They pretended it didn't, ran it through his house. Then they ran it live on CBC, and they
CBS.
And they refused to put the info out because it just seemed suspicious.
So he was the first remote tech worker, is what?
Basically, yes.
So, okay, but it sounds like a lot of data for a UNIVAC, which is why I'm stumbling on it. Because I mean, didn't that thing have like 12 bits of RAM or something? Like,
I think it was accumulating as it went. Because when I read about how it was done, it was a whole. They had to encode the data on a whole bunch of paper tape that they would constantly feed in as they got other results. So it was probably just keeping a tabulature or something.
Interesting.
I don't know. Like, I can program this thing. I don't know, Quinn.
As you were talking about that, I ran out and grabbed the president-elect, strategic simulation ink box that I was just recently scanning. I think I once did know what the history of the blue and the red indications were. I think that is somewhat recent. It may actually be 2000 when it actually took on its...
Yeah, that is pretty recent. And America's, for some reason, are backwards from the rest of the world. Like everyone else... uses red for the left and blue for the right.
Oh, America doesn't? What do you guys do?
America is red for the right and blue for the left.
Oh, that's odd. Interesting. But there was that whole flip-flop on the Democrats and Republicans you guys had.
Yeah, this was all after that, though. The color associations are all way after that, yeah.
America wants to go its own way. Paul, answer for yourself.
Start,
That's true. Yeah. Anyway, it is kind of interesting, though, the goal of these, this is the newer 1988 one. It says on the back, it says, after Reagan, who will be next in 88? Find out today with president-elect.
So that's a game about the fascinating exercise of crunching electoral college poll numbers.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Apparently. Yeah. You can see there's a little illustration of the U.S. and in Apple II graphics with the red and blue, states. Anyway.
Oh, SSI. Not everything is fun.
I think
just because it has numbers doesn't mean it's fun.
I think there was somewhere this came up, that the SSI was actually not hit as hard by some of the software piracy of the era because you make something nobody wants.
Yeah, that's funny how that works.
Yeah. Nobody pirates it. But anyway.
Nothing I made has ever been pirated either. I wonder if that's related.
Right.
I pirated your stuff.
Hold on. Maybe I'll talk about the thing. Oh, Quinn, did you have a thing that you wanted to?
I don't. I was so riveted by Carrington's that I forgot to look anything up.
Oh, that's fine.
You knew you would be riveted.
Exactly.
Anticipate.
Yeah.
So the idea I had was to talk about things relating to compression, which I mean I think there are probably various things that one could talk about, but so there was this paper that David Huffman produced, a method for the construction of minimum redundancy codes, right? So I only sort of know how Huffman compression works, but I mean I think essentially the idea is just that it looks over the field of data, figures out what's most frequent and represents that in a smaller number of bits, so that you're able to kind of just reduce the size of things. And the story behind it is actually kind of interesting. It was the way that the lore goes, at least, is that essentially there was a class. Huffman was in the class, and there was an option of like either writing a paper or taking a final, and he didn't want to take the final. So he basically wrote up something to try to make a provably minimally redundant code, and which is something that the professor at the time was actually also working on, and it sort of came to him at the last second, a way that he could write this out, and it turned out to be, provably minimally redundant, and so that was sort of the origin of it, and so people talk about this as like, one of these cases where there's kind of like a hard unsolved problem that the professor had in his own research, and leaves it open to the students, and the students get it. But
so just to be clear here, because he didn't want to take an exam, he invented the entire field of data compression.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I used to do that all the time.
Yeah.
For the record, I did not.
Yeah. But so there's a site actually. Called HuffmanCoding.com that has a lot of this information on it. And what I think is really kind of endearing about this is this is like the Huffman family site with some additional stuff about Uncle David's compression algorithms.
It's a whole my family section. Yeah,
it's a family business.
Yeah, so if you want to, you can find out about various people's adoptions, or you can find out about the Huffman algorithm.
This was the minimal size to put this information out there.
That's
perfectly,
right.
Exactly.
Perfectly reasonable.
But
this is a very 90s web page, though, in the sense of like the cross section of content. Like, yeah. Here's pictures of my dog, and here's my computer science research, and here's a picture of our house. Like, that was everybody's right. Website in the 90s.
Right.
It's under construction.
Yeah. 640 pixels wide, though.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's got fancy menus in CSS, but other than that,
right.
90s website.
But there is actually a from 1991. There's a Scientific American article that kind of goes over this some of the story. It's written in an accessible way. So if you want to read about the not taking the final story, you can read that here. But as far as like my own experience with compression, Stuffit figured fairly large in that. So I thought I would at least talk a little bit about Stuffit.
Me too.
I suppose that we all probably had a fairly long experience with that, and it is an experience that is marked with ups and downs. So, I loved Stuffit at the beginning. It was such a like little upstart program. It did everything very quickly, very cleanly. Raymond Lau was the guy who created it, and actually, it turns out I did not realize this, but I may well have walked by this guy many times because he was doing his doctoral dissertation like a couple buildings over from me as I was doing mine. But who knew? Anyway, and he, I think he wrote this thing in high school, Stuffit. So like,
wow.
it was really, I don't know, it was a really neat story. And then it got bought by Smith Micro.
Every time I come on this show, I learn one more. Or I lose one more excuse for why I didn't do anything good in high school with computers.
Right.
I'm just like, oh, well, it was hard at that age. It's like, oh, well, the guy who wrote Eliminator for the Apple II was 16. Like, oh, jeez. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. I didn't have a whole lot more to say about Stuffit except for just like the general nostalgic positivity replaced by the annoyance of the buy a new one every year and add a bunch of bloat to your computer that it became.
And then the annoyance of it not staying as a standard. Like if I encounter .sit files now, it's like, oh, I just like my whole body deflates. It's like, because I can encounter like a really old zip file, my computer's going to be fine with it. I encounter a .sit file, it's like, yeah, good luck with that. It's probably not going to decode. And if it does, it's going to explode into some other things. And it's like, ha, resource forks. Remember those? Suck it. Like, come on. It's like, ah, terrible.
Yeah. Well, and there was some weird overlap. I mean, if you were a 2GS user and a Mac user, because the 2GS had Trinket, which was kind of the same thing, but not exactly. And like some versions of Stuffit would open Trinket files and vice versa, and some wouldn't. And then Stuffit moved on and Trinket kind of stagnated, and it was it got very confusing very quickly. But as you said, in the early days, it was super clean and nice, and you always knew how to decompress something. But yeah, then it got really hard.
Yeah,
it's weird. On screen right now, you've got stuff at 30 years of file compression. How they resisted saying 30 years of file compression in only 5 years is remarkable to me.
Yeah, I think so. Mac Folklore Radio had a. So I don't know if you guys have been listening to this at all. This is Derek. What is his last name? Anyway, Derek of Mac Folklore Radio, who reads these interviews and articles and things like that for you of various sorts. And one of the ones that he did sort of recently was a couple of interviews with Raymond Lau, who made Stuffit originally. And it's interesting. So apparently the main reason that Stuffit came to exist is because the competitors or like the other options had this bad property where if you wanted the fifth file in an archive, you had to decompress the first four first before you could decompress the fifth. And so he thought, well, that's dumb. You know, we can do better than that. And so he wrote Stuffit to do that. And it's then just sort of put it out and it spread. I think this might be a case where it really did spread because it was good. You know, like people liked it. It did everything they wanted. The developer was responsive and added stuff, but I don't think it was really marketed. It was just shareware for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it handled resource forks, right, which was the big thing on the Mac because nothing else understood those files, those split file formats that the Mac used.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so... that's all, I guess. The other thing maybe that is worth talking about, perhaps, although I don't know as much about it, is PKware.
Yeah, I was going to say, speaking of things that, you know, became popular because they were good but then got bad, PKZip on DOS was that, right? Like, in the beginning there was Zip, and it was sort of okay, and it was kind of crappy, but then, like, word spread, you know, in the early 90s about PKZip, and that became the cool thing that everyone used, and again, because it was just so much better. But then somewhere in the 2000s or something, it got to that same stage where you weren't sure what PKZip was anymore. It was this giant thing that claimed to handle 58 different formats. And, it started as this super simple command line thing that everybody had installed. And you just knew if you saw, you know, one of those files, you could PK unzip it. But, then it bloated and migrated and turned into something horrible.
Bloat is pretty ironic for a compression software.
Yeah.
That is ironic.
Yes, and it did seem to happen to all of them.
It did. Yeah, they all like got corporate or something.
Have you considered consolidating all your compression softwares into one handy compression software?
Well, I put them all in Disk Doubler, so then that solved that
problem.
There you go. I feel like there's something about compression software where it's like a coming of age for computing, right? Like that's the moment where your computing gets big, right? Because it wasn't really a thing, you know, on the 8-bits, right? Like, I mean, we downloaded games from BBSs and stuff. I mean, legal backups from BBSs and such. But I don't even remember. Those were compressed somehow, or does anyone remember? I don't remember uncompressing
usually not,
things.
No.
Yeah, I think so. I think there was one
just
of the
compression in the transmission.
But, yeah, like Zed modem or whatever would compress it for download, but then it came as a 140K file to your disk, to your machine.
There was, for the Apple II, I think there was one disk imaging program called Dalton Disk Disintegrator that I think did compress things down. Like, it probably did stuff like eliminate sectors full of zeros and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't very sophisticated, but yeah. It was slightly smaller.
Because I remember that from my migration to the 2GS, where I went from having no idea what compression was or using it, except for, you know, my DOS friends were using PKZip by then, but to suddenly needing to understand Shrinkit, and because everything came Shrinkited, and I needed to know all about this and how that all worked. And then when moving to the Mac, then stuff, it was immediately familiar because of that. But it just, yeah, it suddenly became this normal part of your life, whereas a year or 2 years prior to that, it was something I'd never heard of.
Yeah. It was kind of interesting that the you mentioned Disk Doubler, and you know, that was sort of an interesting next step, which I kind of feel like that kind of went away again. I don't think we have anything that's similar to that. It just gets, you know, sent to the cloud and deleted from your local drive.
Yeah, that's an interesting phenomenon, those hard drive level compression tools, because they existed in this very narrow niche where hard drives were still expensive, but data was growing fast, and it just didn't last very long. That lasted for a couple of years, and then the price of hard drives just fell through the floor, and nobody needed to take the risk, basically, of using those things, because they were a risk. Like, you never really knew if your data was still going to be there tomorrow, because mostly they worked, but sometimes it would just get corrupted, and then your entire hard drive was gone. Those things were a little terrifying, but I used them on my Mac, my PowerBook 100. I had, was it disk doubler or what was there? Was a Mac one, and there was one big Mac one and one big PC one that everybody used for that. I forget what they were called. Yeah, they both had catchy names.
Disk doubler was the Mac one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was auto doubler too, which was sort of similar, and there were a couple others that
auto doubler. That's what I used. Auto doubler. That was it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were scary things, like, because you knew. As soon as you turned that on, like, the data on your hard drive wasn't your data anymore. Now it was in this intermediate format that you might lose the ability to read. Maybe today.
Yeah.
Now it's called cloud computing.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have been doing a lot of scanning and stuff recently, and a lot of the workflow, basically, you know, I scan things into 1200 DPI TIFF files, and then I fiddle with them and eventually get them down to like 40 megabyte PDFs or whatever. But I keep all the, you know, giant TIFF files just up in the Dropbox away from me. Yeah. So, nobody cares about this anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I actually just bought a NAS, or actually I was given an old NAS. And I mean, I have a YouTube channel, BlondieHacks.com, as some may know. And so I produce like gigabytes and gigabytes of data a day basically now. And I just bought two 12 terabyte spindles and dropped it in there. And I mean, it wasn't expensive at all. And like, it never even occurs to me to bother compressing any of that. Cause yeah, I could probably compress it and get 40% of that storage back, but it's just not worth the trouble. Like, it's going to take forever, and it's going to be harder to access the data later. I'm going to have somewhere to uncompress it to. It's just easier to go on Amazon and buy another 12 terabyte disk when I need it.
Yep.
And especially with a NAS, because you can just hot swap it and it automatically formats it and stripes it, and just, it's all magic. So yeah, it's pretty great.
The one place where I think that might, I was tempted to do, you know, some of this kind of like on-disk compressing, is the fact that like my minis both have little tiny SSD boot drives. I mean, SSD is nice and all, but I mean, what is this, you know, 128 gig or whatever? I mean, like,
a drive for ants?
Yeah, Apple's pretty stingy with the boot disks on that. I actually upgraded the one in my MacBook Pro that I'm recording on right now, which was also a terrifying process, but so worth it. Like, I put in one of those, there's a site you can go online where you say, you know, buy this exact model of Samsung terabyte SSD, and you can swap it in there, and it doubled the storage for basically zero effort. And that was so worth it. Like, that was... That was a huge improvement. But yeah, I was right at that point too, where I was considering on disk compression options again, because space was so tight on the boot disk.
And it really doesn't, like, it doesn't take much for something to run away and eat it all up. I mean, like, you know, like, things do run away sometimes.
Yeah. Like, in my case, it was Final Cut Pro by default backs up all of your work to its own local file on the boot disk, because that's where the app is installed.
Yeah.
Which is the dumbest default setting in history. So every video project I've ever worked on has most of a copy of itself in a hidden folder on the boot disk. It took me years to find that. I was like, where is this space going? And so finally I found that and then turned that setting off. But like, really, Apple? Stupid. But then, I mean, a lot of modern formats too, though, the compression doesn't buy you that much, right? Like, that's... Mm-hmm. Another challenge, maybe why we don't use it so much today, is because like most of that, all that data I'm talking about there is all MPEG-4, and compressing that's already compressed. So most of our big data today is image, video, and audio formats that are already compressed. So not a lot of gain there probably.
Yeah, that is really depressing when you say zip this MP4 or whatever.
It's like, it's bigger.
And it's like, okay, you know, I saved 0.01 gigabytes. That's great.
That's great.
All right. Has Quinn frozen?
Maybe. It was funny, what she's saying, though, about compression, marking that point where in our our joint computer lives where data starts outstripping storage. And it's funny because now that I'm thinking about it, I did kind of go through three phases of computing where early on it's like everything's really expensive, can't afford stuff, hard drives are enormous but insanely expensive, but all the stuff I want to work with is little games and whatever. And then you move into the 90s and I'm suddenly doing desktop publishing and you've got these Quark files and everything's massive and I can't afford to buy a 500 megabyte drive. Who can nowadays? You've got icons that are big, but it was and I remember at work us getting a bunch of drives to put on the network our first time, and they were, I think, 500 megabyte drives. And there were four of them, and we bought them used from our parent company passing down, because it's okay, that's the only way we can get these stuff going for a price that this little company can afford. And the idea now is okay, let's just put all our important company data on four used drives that will stick in. Ooh, that was a gamble. But I rated them, but still it's crazy. But so it was so expensive. But then there was this period where I'm compressing things and I'm using StuffIt or Zip, and I'm using Distubbler and all these things. And then eventually, just storage sizes just explode. Where nowadays, everything's 2 terabyte, 4 terabyte. Oh, there's my 18 terabyte drives over there. And I don't know when it happened, but at some point, I've crossed into storage is infinite. I don't care. I'll just throw more storage at it. And it's such a different world to live in now, where I just keep all the giant files and five copies of them, and I don't really care anymore. And I'll just search for them. And it's weird how that's been the cycle of computing. So.
Yeah,
and now
yeah.
Space is infinite. Space is big, really big. You just wouldn't believe how mind-bogglingly big it is.
That's got to be pretty close to verbatim.
Yeah, close enough. I compressed.
Yeah.
It was a lossy compression, though.
Are you done? Are you done with this joke?
Am I? Am I? What do you think, Quinn?
I'm just going to interrupt you now.
If you were better, what would you think?
I don't know if this was covered while I was busy blue screening because StreamYard. Did we talk about cloud storage and why compression is useful there again?
No, we did not.
All right. So we talked briefly about how cloud storage is infinite, so nobody cares anymore. But now the new limiting factor, right, is networking speed, especially up, right? A lot of us have dark ages American internet where you get 300 megabits down if you're lucky, and 5 up, which is I think what I have. So I would love to have cloud backup, but it would take me literally years just to upload all of my data. So it just isn't worth it to do that, even if I could get the space cheap online. So that's a new area where compression might be handy, just to reduce the upload.
Yeah, I am no longer with Crash Plan, but I had been with their they had an unlimited personal backup, and I took full advantage. I have a Plex
server.
And
you're the reason they no longer have an unlimited personal backup.
Yeah, and it really did. I think it took a year and a half to get my Plex server up there. And then they switched to some other plan, option. I lost my free plan, and it's I can't afford that.
Yeah, a lot of the backup services will do incremental updates, so once that initial big upload is done, but I kind of don't trust it, because that's the same thing that Time Machine does locally for my Macs. But every so often, once a year or so, it just gives me a message saying, hey, your Time Machine backup's corrupted, we have to regenerate it, and so it starts all over again. And so I don't know if that's just Time Machine, but I don't trust any of these incremental backup systems to not do that. So it's going to, once again, have to re-upload everything sooner or later. I don't think any incremental system is totally bulletproof.
Yeah, and it is frustrating when the backup. So now I'm using – now I've been using Backblaze, and that works fairly well. But, the occasionally when there are issues – so there's one particular thing that's, I think, specific to this you know, that company, but when they do their incremental uploading, they basically, they create a log file that it always grows. You know, it says like, here's what happened to this file. And if you delete that file, then there's a thing that later, after it talks about where it moved, it talks about how it was deleted. And you know, you can imagine that if you have millions of files, that this can get pretty big. And they consider it a catastrophe if that file ever grows smaller. So like, it is a part of the design decision that this cannot shrink. And often, you know, so you know, mine got very, very large, and you know, at a certain point, it was basically, you know, like the suggested solution was, oh well, okay, just, you know, just upload it again, you know, start over, and that will make your file smaller. It's like, yeah, but it took 9 months.
I thought with Backblaze you could send a drive.
I think you might be able to, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
You can start by sending them the data, and it gets loaded in. It's okay, and then we back up from there. So you can send them a snapshot, and that's where you start to save the 9 months of upload.
Yeah, oh, that's interesting. Wasn't there an XKCD or something about that? How like there's still no data transfer method that can compete with a station wagon full of hard drives, like in terms of like throughput. Like the ping is really bad, but the throughput, you just can't beat it. Yeah. It takes you 2 days to drive there.
I'm sure that's still true.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's like it still is.
That could be somebody's offsite backup. Like you'd be a business where you just get a van and you just drive a big circle around North America and you say, like, I'm going to be at your space every 2 weeks. And you just like, here are your drives. Let's swap stuff. Okay. See ya. And you just keep driving. Where's your stuff? It's Bob's truck and he's going around North America. It's safe. Right. My stuff right now is in Colorado.
This is somehow related to Snowpiercer, right?
Yeah,
obviously.
Exactly.
All businesses should be run that way.
It's January. So my data is in Alaska. I actually liked that movie. I would patronize seriously that service because I love like my NAS. Like it's fast and it's reliable. Like it can rebuild drives that fail, which I've had happen, and I just swap a new drive in, rebuilds it. So it's very reliable and very fast. But if my house burns down, I lose everything. So or if someone breaks in and steals this very expensive looking box sitting in, you know, in plain sight. So you know, that's a concern. So if I ever
jump on the hashtag van life thing, this is how I'll support it. I will just drive my van around North America, just swap and drive
hard drives.
There you go. Yeah.
Carrington's mobile data center.
Yep. And what I would use is other people's houses and say, I've got three copies of your stuff, and one is there at Rachel's and one is there at Robert's. Like, I'll go around and get them, and it's all good. It's all backed up.
You could run that's it all on cool. batteries and just charge up at people's houses while you're waiting. Totally. Wouldn't even have to pay for the power.
Nope.
Like also occurs to me, as you mentioned the very expensive box, that might be another market sector is making even more expensive looking boxes that you can put next to your expensive looking box so that people will take the decoy.
Yeah, exactly. It's like those people that put the like glass detection tape on their windows, the break detection tape, but don't actually have an alarm system. They just do that so that they'll break into your house instead.
Yeah.
That was a thing in the 80s.
You go over to a neighbor's house and you stick that stuff on? Or
no, like people would put that stuff, because in the 80s, burglar alarm systems, they had to have the tape because we don't have this fancy sensors that we have nowadays. So you'd go down the street and you'd see houses with this tape on their windows for their burglar alarms. But pretty soon people figured out you could just put the tape on your windows and not buy the system. Or like people nowadays, the equivalent is people steal the ADT sign off your lawn because right. If you have the sign, that's enough, right? Like you don't actually have to pay for the service. You just need the sign.
This is pretty much the same kind of thing as like the unattended police cars by the side of the road. Actually,
exactly.
I've seen a nice one of like a 2D like
cardboard cutout.
Police car.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just like the department is run by Wile E. Coyote. Look, I've got an idea. We're gonna paint a tunnel to get all the criminals.
I actually had an RCMP officer tell me once they will put an empty car on the side of the road, but then a mile down the road they'll have a real one because everyone speeds up after they pass the first car. And they catch everyone at the second one. Get those quotas.
Excellent. Okay, let's see. We were talking about compression, right?
We're talking about 1952. Yeah.
That's I remember now. It did all connect in some way.
It always does.
However, I think we probably can move on from that unless any further thoughts are needed. Okay. Now we can get to the items of interest. There's some feedback. Let me talk a little bit about the feedback. So one thing that came in over Facebook was David posted something that Retro Magazine issue 13 is out. We have now talked about issue 11 and 12, so it's possible we will not continue talking about every single one of them, but now I actually did read like the first paragraph, which does say it does not come in a physical issue. It comes in two versions, Italian and English, and the Creative Commons license allows you to print one off if you want on your own. If you feel the need to have a magazine you can spill coffee on, this is how you do it. Anyway, it basically covers a lot of retro topics. It's really nicely laid out. We've talked about it a couple times. It focuses a little more on the 90s than I do, but that's okay. It also has a sort of European perspective too, so it focuses more on things, computers and systems that were more popular in Europe, and so I don't know them as well, but. And interviews with people who have done new games. And there was one thing that I discovered here that I did not know about before. I don't know if I can find it. Hopefully I will make everybody ill on the stream while I scroll through this. But there was a game called Bubble Bobble, and I think, you know, somehow that led to the creation of a game called Puzzle Bobble, which it turns out is at the same game as Snood. I did not know that. I knew Snood. I didn't know Puzzle Bobble. Anyway, that's all. Anyone else know either Puzzle Bobble or Snood?
Snood, definitely.
Actually, the name Puzzle Bobble sounds familiar, but I don't remember it. I've never heard of Snood.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. It's good. It's like one of the best things to play on like classic Mac.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But
yep, I played many games of Snood.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. So there's that. A different David, also on Facebook, posted something to indicate that he has a couple of magazines up that he wrote in. But this is David All with his Creative Computing magazines that he's put up on eBay. And so if you want a David All signed Creative Computing, he's the editor, right? I think he's the one who sort of basically started the magazine. There are still several available. It's under the seller name Katie Winston. But that's where David All sells his stuff. And it's cool that he's on our Facebook page.
That is cool. David?
Yeah. Okay, let's see. We talked a little bit about Deathlord Relorted, I think, last time.
Love the name. Yeah. Love the name so much.
I've been following that on Twitter. It's awesome.
Yeah. And Tim wrote over email just to sort of fill us in on the background of this, which essentially was that this YouTube channel, The Lost Sectors, went through a playthrough of Deathlord and got a conversation started. But so if you wanted to watch the live play of Deathlord, it's
so many hours,
50 hours or something like that. And then
the older
discussion.
I get, the fewer games I play. 50 hours.
Yeah.
Oh.
But anyway, there was some discussion in their Discord channel, and that led to the development of this Deathlord Relorted, which is essentially just kind of like a skin over the original game. So, I mean, it's a very sophisticated skin. basically, it's an emulator designed for this purpose. But what else? The only other thing I'll mention is that Klaus wrote over email wondering about something that may be just a topic for the future. It's not something I know the answer to, but was wondering sort of about whether hardware, particularly of the sort that we are concerned with, like vintage 80s hardware, is likely to be more reliable if it is regularly used or if it is put away in a closet. Because he's got a Commodore 64 from 1984 that he put in a closet 5 years ago and then took back out and it didn't work. And he's got a Commodore 64 from 1983, which is supposed to be less reliable, but he kind of uses it all the time, and it still works fine.
And he, being statistically significant himself, will draw conclusions from this.
Yeah, it's a pretty small N on that data set, but...
Yeah, I think it was basically just the thing that led him to wonder.
It's an interesting question. We talked about this once before, about the old myth or... possibly miss that it's better to leave your computer on all the time than to turn it on and off every time you use it, which is not something we think about nowadays because everything's always on. But
I absolutely remember that being a thing that everybody would say. Yeah,
it was a big thing. Yeah, I never really believed it because people used to say the same thing about light bulbs. And that was definitely an urban myth. People would say that it was better to leave them on all the time because they always burn out when you turn them on, I think. So that led people to intuit that, oh, leaving them on is gentler for the bulb or whatever.
Mm-hmm. It was a lie spread by Big Bulb to get you to
yeah,
buy
exactly.
more bulbs.
Yeah. So somewhere along the way, National Geographic or someone actually tested it. This is all pre-Snopes, but someone actually tested it. And no, it's like the bulb lasts half as long if you leave it on. But so that, I think, led me to distrust that belief about computers. But I mean, I think the basis for the argument would be the thermal expansion and contraction. Like if that's bad enough for the computer to be worth it. But I mean, I think the thermal stress of the computer running is probably worse. I think that a computer may be likely to fail, though, if it's been sitting because it's going to get like corrosion and stuff on the pins. Mm-hmm. And then when you turn it on and things warm up, things are going to shift and, you know, chips are going to shift in the sockets and stuff. But I think like reseat the chips and stuff is probably fine.
So do you think powering it on and off is any sort of protection against corrosion? I wonder.
That's a good question. I don't know if there's some sort of electrolytic component to the corrosion. Maybe. I would think the current would make it worse, though, not better, if that were the case.
Hmm. And if you think about things like the mechanical parts, like a power supply fan running all the time,
yeah.
bearings and things,
yeah,
you can only run stuff so long.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything moving, it's a no-brainer. Running it is always worse than not running it. Yeah. Like your bearings and fans are going to wear out for sure. And then, I mean, capacitors, the other big failure point there, I don't think it matters because that's just time. They either leak or they don't. It has nothing to do with whether you're using them, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think it's just about it has a lifespan. Use it, don't use it, whatever.
Yeah. The same person, Klausen, on the Facebook page posted some photos of like old Pong consoles from the 1970s that he dug out, and those also seemed, he opened them up, the capacitors all look fine, he was kind of thinking that maybe what this means is that in certain areas things were better, they used to be made better, the 1970s capacitors were not made in whatever way led the 90s ones to leak.
It's definitely the case that the older I get, the more I will claim that things before used to be better. And that does seem to be a universal trait. So it's probably the case that old things were better.
Yeah.
So it is the case that there is a specific era of capacitors that were bad. It was, in fact, it's called the capacitor plague. And there's even a Wikipedia page about it. It was a specific manufacturing change that was made in like 1987 or something. And so that's why all the caps from like 87 to 2000 are the ones that go bad. But yeah, prior to that, like the 70s ones didn't have this issue for sure of going bad. So yeah, there's a pretty interesting Wikipedia page on that. So yeah, it's not the case that they all go bad. And the older stuff's just simpler too. Like the, the integration on the chips is much lower. Like you've got 555 timers and, very simple chips that are low density, and so they're not likely to corrode in ways that are going to fail. The clock speeds are lower, so they're less sensitive to bad connections on chip legs and things like that. So I think there's a lot of that as well. And then things get more reliable again when they stop socketing the chips and so on. So there's sort of a window of terribleness there in the late 80s, early 90s, where you got the bad capacitors and the socketed chips and high clock speeds, and it's a perfect storm of things just going to start failing. It would be interesting to get more data on that, though, because there are some things in this world that do last longer if you use them. Cars, for example, counterintuitively, you can't let cars sit too long. The bearings dry out, seals dry out. So you want to keep oil pressure, you want to keep the fluid circulating. Gas goes bad if you don't use it, things like that. So, it's an old movie trope that they find an old muscle car that's been sitting there for 100 years in a museum or whatever, like Demolition Man, and they just jump in it and drive away. Like, no, like that gas would be rotten. All the seals would be bad. Those bearings would all be seized. Like, that's not happening.
Might make a good sort of comic moment, though, when it realistically it doesn't do anything. It just sort of falls off to the side.
Exactly. But yeah, it would be interesting to, know more about the real causes of some of those things like corrosion or chips getting loose in sockets and whether reusing the machine is better or worse for those symptoms. I don't know.
Yeah. All right. thanks everybody for sending that. And now we can go to items of interest and news. Carrington has the first of these.
I'm first. Thought I was second. I'm first. Sure, I can be first. When you give people tenure, they'll make weird classes, is the lesson I'm going to give you now. So Monmouth College, I don't know it, but it's in Monmouth, Illinois. There is a professor, Brad Rowe, got it showing a thing on screen right now, who spent his sabbatical last fall getting into typewriters and learning to repair typewriters. So when he comes back to college, he says, I should teach a class on typewriters because I'm into them. Yeah. So now Monmouth College will be teaching typing. We had talked a few episodes ago about taking typing in high school. It was a thing you would do at a certain period in people's lives. And mine, I overlap with that. In high school, there was typing. I took typing, and it served me really well my whole life now, being a fast touch typist. Well, Professor Brad Rowe is bringing back typing. If you go to Monmouth College, you can take a typing class. Now, when professors do this kind of thing, and it's like, I'm interested in this, and I have tenure, let's do a class. This class will include things like, there will be two poets on hand who will type up a poem for you on a typewriter that you'll be able to keep. And so, what's the value of this class? I'm not sure, but typewriter is coming back. He taught a small class. I've got a quote up here on screen for some kids as a kind of trial balloon for this, and taught kids how to type a letter and then put it in the mail. And the kids were like, this is the first time I ever sent mail. So there's lots of things that younger people are not doing anymore. They don't touch typewriters. Sending postal mail? Nope. And so who knows if the college kids at Monmouth College will get something out of their credit in this. But if you are thinking of picking a college for the new year, and something that was really important to you was learning how to type on an old typewriter, then Monmouth can hook you up, but you might want to consider it at least as one of your safety colleges. So. Typing is back and big in Illinois.
I like the kids angle on that a lot, like teaching kids how to type and send, especially the sending a letter in the mail thing, because that, you know, that's part of being a citizen, and it's not something that younger people may have necessarily done. The rest of it, though, I would say a cautionary tale about giving hipsters tenure.
Right. Although, like, typing is a great skill. Typing has served me so well in, like, everything I've ever done. Being able to type really fast without looking down has been great for me.
But do they not teach typing anymore?
But that's what I'm saying. Like, can't you learn typing without a typewriter?
Surely in junior high school or whatever, you can take a typing class on a computer, right?
One would assume so. But just in case that's not part of your high school, Monmouth. Monmouth's where we want to go. Paul is considering transferring to start teaching at Monmouth now, aren't you, Paul? Look what they'll let you
Absolutely.
Do.
Yeah, well, I was kind of curious to know, like, what it looks like this person's in educational studies or something. So, because I was wondering, you know, what field do you have to be in to be allowed to do this?
I'm willing to bet a lot of even our listeners have forgotten how much work typewriters were, because computer keyboards are so much easier, they're gentler to type on. Like the mechanical ones, like shown in this picture here, those typewriters are a lot of work. Like your fingers
jam so much easier than you'd think if you're not good at it. When I've used a mechanical typewriter, it's like the jam. It's like, what's going on? You have to be really smooth and accurate with how you're spacing out typing. And the fact that in old movies you see people type really fast on a manual typewriter, that is a remarkable skill. Because if I try to type quickly on a manual, I just jam up the keys.
Yeah, and my hands are sore in 5 minutes because how hard you have to push those keys and how far they have to travel to do their action. It's brutal.
So it's the same thing now if I handwrite anything. If I try to handwrite half a page of text.
Oh, that hurts, yeah.
And I used to write full – I can't believe how much I would, as a kid, be able to handwrite full essays in school. Yeah. And now if I sign my name, I have a long name. At the end of 26 letters, I'm like, I don't know.
You gonna change your name to Carrington Van just because?
Van. Well, actually, I get a lot of mail addressed to Carrington because you normally only get 9 letters and those fill your name thing. So, a lot of mail gets addressed to Carrington.
Yeah, no, it's true. Every so often, I handwrite a thank you note or something, and it kills. Like just
that's why I don't thank anybody for anything.
That's right.
That's the reason.
I actually seem to remember when I was using a manual one, the keys weren't quite big enough. So I would occasionally, my finger would miss and go into the, like under the key top.
Your finger
hurts.
Goes between them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because it's spread out so much bigger. We get used to these smaller form factors.
Yeah. Well, and the key sizes and spacings weren't as standard as they are now. So some of them, they're just these little tiny metal buttons on each key that are like 10 feet apart. And some of them, like, yeah, it's not so standard.
I can't reach the cue.
So it needs, you need both power and accuracy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like the one on the left here in this photo, like there's a lot of space between those keycaps. Like there's all kinds of finger-eaten room there.
That was the discarded Kentucky Fried Chicken slogan.
Exactly. Yeah, that one didn't test well.
All right. I think I have the... Do I have the next one? Yes, I am alphabetically next. So the thing I had was basically... This was actually just sort of lifted off of feedback. But so Matthew on Twitter pointed us to TubeTime's project on the quad link, which is kind of interesting. So I thought I would talk a little bit about, or at least just mention the existence of this thread. I think we've talked about this before, the QuadLink by QuadRAM, but it is a board that you put in your IBM PC that has an Apple II on it. So this is a way that you can turn your IBM PC into an Apple II also.
Is that called an upgrade by anybody?
It's like a lateral move at best.
Yeah. I think again, this is a moment in time, but it was probably quite a bit cheaper to reuse all the components except the brain.
And if you
want
to play
way.
A bunch of games at work, but have your boss not tell from, it's like, oh, look at this PC on my desk. It's full of boring stuff. As soon as he walks around the corner, choplifter.
Yeah, it's sort of tempting in the modern day, partly because it's curious, but also because now it's a lot of desk space for two 80s computers,
right?
Right. Particularly if one of them is a PC, but the Apple II is not small either. Anyway, so what the TubeTime is doing is, I don't think there's a video associated with this at the moment, although I imagine there might be, but this is just, it's a Twitter thread, and it's sort of basically going through repairing and reverse engineering this card. TubeTime says about the size of one of Wilt Chamberlain's bedroom slippers. It is very large.
An international standard of measurement.
British standard, I think.
Yeah. However, so it's actually kind of neat, like looking through the photos of the stuff in the box. And in fact, in the manual itself, it says if you're an engineer or an experienced technician, you could wire the quad link to a power supply, a monitor, a disk drive, and run it independently of any other computer. It's it's just using the PC pieces. And that's pretty impressive for a circuit board the size of one of Wilt Chamberlain's bedroom slippers.
This, scroll up a bit. This manual is delightful.
Yeah.
Like, who wrote this? Look at that. Like, why? That was really easy, you'll say when you're done. And you'll be right. Like, who writes manuals like this? I just want to read this manual.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. So what's happening here is all of the sockets are being lifted up so that the traces can be examined. And eventually we get to CAD drawings or whatever you call them, of the circuits. I don't know if a clone is in the works, but it seems like it might be part of the plan here. So in all of your IBM 5150s that you have, you can also have Apple IIs.
There were so many of these products back in the day, especially for putting Apple IIs in other things, but they were always only Apple II pluses. Always bothered me, which always kind of rendered them pretty useless for most things that you actually wanted to use. I just feel like the market for these products just never really existed also. Like there was, the PC transporters for the Apple and then all these Apple II things for Commodores and PCs and stuff. But like, did anyone ever buy these things? Because it doesn't seem like anyone ever needed to use two different platforms at the same time.
At work, we had for accounting departments at some point be an all Mac company, and they would need PC software for accounting. But even then, they generally were running it in emulation by that point, some sort of virtualized PC.
Mm-hmm. There were orange PC cards for the Mac that you could get that would have a something 86 on them. And my recollection of the PC transporter is that what that is a very slow PC in your Apple II.
Yeah, it was a PC XT. I actually had a friend who had one in his 2GS. It was a PC XT with CGA graphics, which, again, rendered it basically useless. Like, and I mean, this was early 90s by this point. So, a CGA XT by that point is useless. But again, it's like, if you have a 2GS at that point, you're so committed to that platform, why would you occasionally want to run PC software very badly? I don't know. I never understood if the market for these things really existed or not.
Well, the chat, Jeremy Rand is saying that he did an engineering degree with a GS and a PC transporter, and he used that for DOS things like Turbo Pascal. It was slow, but it worked for him.
Okay.
And now he knocks out new Apple II software, probably three or four during this podcast. So
exactly.
You know,
all right.
Just do
so
what Jeremy
bought
does
one.
Is what I say. General rule, just do Jeremy stuff.
I mean, my friend had one just because he was a gadget guy and he had disposable income, so he bought it just because it was neat, but he didn't really use it. We ran Ultima 6 once on it just to show that it could be done, but it wasn't really usable. But yeah, okay.
Cool. Yeah, I also think they're neat and have a few of them, you know, that I acquired in modern times, but I haven't really tried them. Like I have one for the Epson QX10 called the QX-PC that has that will put an IBM PC, a reportedly unbelievably slow IBM PC inside your Epson QX10. Right. But I've not tried it.
Are there any emulators that emulate this kind of thing? You want to emulate like an Apple with a PC thing in it or whatever?
That's a good question.
I think that is that should be a high priority for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, with the schematics and everything that this guy's reverse engineering, that's enough information for MAME to emulate one of these things. So, yeah. I wouldn't be shocked if MAME is doing that with one of these devices already.
Yeah.
Maybe one of the more popular ones, like the PC Transporter.
That would be pretty funny, actually. I did, I just remembered, this is some years ago. I have an IBM 5155, which is the portable IBM PC, and I stuck one of these quad link things in it because at the time, I think I must have talked about this before, but I thought, you know, I'll just bring this to Kansas Fest. This is a nice portable Apple II.
Portable.
Yeah, it's actually very, very heavy. and the thing about it is the integration is not great. It really is, you know, it's kind of borrowing the keyboard, but it doesn't borrow the screen. The PC shows the PC stuff and the composite out shows the Apple II stuff. It's not really that much of a portable Apple II. It's really just a very heavy case to put the Apple II in. You still need all the external stuff. I think it also taps into the disk drive. So
yeah, it's interesting how they were all kind of different levels of integration with the host system, as it were, the Parasite system. Some of them, it was just like using the motherboard for power, basically, and you had to have external everything else. So the rest were sort of a mix. Like, yeah, the PC Transporter had to have its own floppy drives, but I think it used the built-in video, if I'm not mistaken. But some of them you had to have your own keyboard and other weird things.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. And we can move on to one of Quinn's many collected links.
Yes, I was instructed to add news items, so I added news items. I'm going to start with one that I feel like must have been covered at some point, but maybe it's still in the queue, but it seems like Apple might be trying to patent the home computer now. So this is an article on Hackaday where someone dug up this patent, and it's a patent for a computing device inside of a keyboard, or a keyboard on top of a built-in computing device of some sort. And
the Commodore 64.
The description of it sounds exactly like an Apple II, a Commodore 64, an Atari 400, an Atari 800. Or the current Raspberry, what do they call those, Raspberry Pi 400s or whatever, they're similar. So, and you might think, well, okay, someone's being silly about how they interpret this patent, and it's not really about that. But the actual patent is linked in here, and if you click over to it and read it, which I did, I'll spare the viewers this because there's no pictures, it's just a very dense piece of text, but it really is just that. Like, it's describes a general purpose computing device with a built-in fan and a built-in keyboard that has a certain form factor, and it really is just seemingly a description of an Apple II they've decided to now patent, and it's a bit of a mystery. So
but does it this is only applied for, right?
Yes.
Like it's not granted because it does seem like prior art is clearly that's not going to pass that test, right?
But it's actually – it's weirdly easy to get patents. I have a ton of patents.
Yeah.
And so it's really more about, okay, you've claimed this and now patent office will then go fight it out in court or whatever. Somebody said – and so if something gets – If the word gets out ahead of time, people can jump on it and say, hey, it's prior art, whatever, and I don't want to grant that patent. But you get patents for stuff, and it doesn't actually mean anything unless it's defensible. But it could also be, I'm thinking, like, people don't know stuff. Like, young people don't, like, we are all like, yeah, that's a TS-80 Model 1, what are you thinking? But it could be that, like, people in Apple are working on a keyboard that is just the whole device, and then Apple's lawyers look at that, and the Apple's lawyers are, you know, 14 years old, and they go, oh, hey, this is a new thing. We better patent that to get out in front of other people and be able to rip off our original idea. And they simply have no idea of anything created before, you know, in the 1900s when I was born. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's cool. I think it's more cynical than that. I think this is just part of a corporate strategy that all these companies do now, which is to just carpet bomb patent applications in the hopes that someday that will be, you know, legal real estate upon which they can, you know, they can sue someone for something. Because like a lot of these companies derive a genuine revenue stream from just suing people over nonsense patents. And like Harrington said, yeah, the position of like certainly the U.S. Patent Office these days is very much just grant everything. And you guys can fight it out in the courts. Like all kinds of nonsensical patents get approved. Like there's someone who patented the idea of producing images on a video screen that made the news. And he got that patent in like 2012. And then went around trying to sue everybody with it. Like, you know, so the whole patent system is basically broken. So it's not too shocking. It won't be shocking if Apple gets this patent. And I think it's not super shocking that they're applying for it again, just on the carpet bomb legal patent space revenue stream modern business model. But it is funny though to see this patent, and the description of it is just like, what? That was 45 years ago.
And it's sort of like, you know, there are these stories about the invention of the post-it note or whatever, where it's like, you know, it was a sort of a failed experiment where they were trying to make something stick and it didn't stick very well, but they thought of some other thing for it. And this is sort of like, well, we had a laptop and then we broke the screen off. And we thought, hey.
Yeah. So I think this is mostly cynical corporate shenanigans, but it's pretty funny anyway.
I'm going to patent the Wilt Chamberlain shoe computer, though, just in case.
Yeah, right.
Just in case.
Excellent.
All right. So I have another quick one that I threw in here that was inspired by that conversation about the Retro Computing magazine. This is something I've been wanting to just shout out quick on the show for a long time now, but kept forgetting to do. So there's a YouTube channel called The Amiga Show, and it's very small, and for a while he was extremely regularly doing weekly videos, and then he went away for a year, and now he's back, but then went away again. So I'm hoping maybe if we shout him out here on the show, he'll keep doing them again, because it's really great. So what's great about it, it's a YouTube channel about Amiga stuff, both historical and current, and it's done entirely on an Amiga.
Nice.
And it's such a sweet spot because YouTube videos can be fairly low res and still be very watchable. We're right in that moment. Like everything hasn't gone 4K yet. So, you know, you can make a Amiga resolution video and still have it be enjoyable to watch on YouTube because the compression and everything is so bad anyway that it doesn't really hurt. And he's done a video behind the scenes as well about his production setup for this, and it's very elaborate. He's got multiple Amigas and video toasters and all the rest. But yeah, it's done entirely on Amigas, everything from writing the script to processing all the footage to all the editing, all the effects and everything. And it's super well done. So every episode, he has a format. Every episode has a game review and some historical stuff and a review of artwork, both past and present, and some community stuff. So really nice, really well done. And maybe we can get more people to watch it and encourage him to make more of these, because I really enjoyed it, and I was sad when I had watched them all.
That is awesome, because like you say, the Amiga is the sweet spot computer to do this on as well with the video.
Yeah.
Like it's just like it's tailor-made for doing this kind of thing.
Yeah,
nice.
Totally.
Very nice.
Yeah. Yeah, he hit a sweet spot here because, like, video got really, really good for a while. Like, all up through the 90s, it got better and better and better. And then, like, Web 2.0 hit and video got real bad again. And so that's his moment to get in there with the Amiga again, because now the Amiga can do, like, you know, 480p level YouTube just fine and do a nice job of it. So, yeah, it's great to see this machine doing this work again. And it's really well done. Like, he does all the effects and everything in Lightroom and all this, you know, the latest and greatest Amiga stuff. Nice. So it's clearly a lot of work, which might be why he's not doing them so much, because you can just tell how much effort is going into every one of these videos. And he showed his production process a little bit, and it makes you appreciate how good computers are now, because, you know, some of the basic, like, chroma key effects or animated graphics and stuff that he's doing now would be, you know, 10 clicks in Apple Motion, but, you know, on an Amiga, it's a very slow, cumbersome process. You're waiting for floppy drives, and you're waiting for the thing to catch up to your last two mouse clicks, and, you know, there's a lot of that. And then you make a mistake, and it doesn't have very good undo because it's only got 128K of RAM, you know. So you forget how – it's easy to forget how easy that stuff is nowadays by comparison. All right, so that was that little bonus item.
All right. I don't know if we want to keep doing bonus items or if you want to – you have all the remaining items and we can save them for later, or we could do them. I don't know.
Let's see. The other two are quick, so I'll do them real quick.
Okay. Yeah, the Apple II video one I'm very interested in.
Yeah, so I like this one. I mean, we have no shortage of Apple II video solutions, but so this is the Lucazi blog, which I know many of you will know him already. He does pretty great Apple II video projects. What I like about this article is it shows the birth of an Apple II video solution. So he is setting out to make an HDMI adapter for the Apple II, and the product is not really the point. Like, we have the VidHD and we have other, you know, we have the VGA to RGB or whatever, the Plamen one. We have all these great solutions already for Apple II video, but this just shows you what the process of developing something like that looks like. So he starts with, you know, some basic understanding of how Apple II video works, and then how do you get something like a Raspberry Pi to generate, to bitbang that video, and what are the limitations of it. He goes through multiple different Raspberry Pi solutions, because, you know, many video adapters use Raspberry Pis for this purpose, for basically real-time video transcoding, but there are a lot of different Raspberry Pis with subtly different limitations as far as, like, throughput on the GPIO, or whether they're limited by, you know, bus bandwidth or whatever. So he goes through some of those sorts of trade-offs and picking just the right Raspberry flavor, if you will, to do this. And then, you know, he talks about the challenges of doing, you know, monochrome versus color, and how to handle all that on the Apple II. So it ends with a mostly working device. He's still working on it, but just the process of development, I think, is really interesting to see, to watch how he gets on with it.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that was that one. His blog is great. Like, you can just...
Yeah, highly recommended.
Yeah, dig through that.
I often go back there. The one posting that I see of his fairly regularly is the reconstruction of the Lego card. So there was a Lego system that the Apple II could drive, and there was a very simple card that, you know, you plug into an external box and lets you run motors and things like that. But as is the way with things Lego, getting the thing with the actual Lego logo on it is very, very expensive. But it's actually quite simple to build, you know, because the card itself is just a very simple serial connection to the box. So he's got a description of kind of like, you know, not only a bunch of Lego stuff there, but how to build that card if you don't want to spend, you know, hundreds of dollars on one that differs only in having the word Lego printed by Lego on it.
Right. All right. So the last little quickie that I have here is a teardown of a Minitel terminal. And, you know, these are things we've talked about off and on over the years, how there was this weird moment in France where they had the internet 10 years before everybody else, and then just quietly nobody knew about it somehow. These were terminals that you could plug in and do your banking and buy plane tickets and whatever, pre-internet. And what I love about this, though, is the form factor on this terminal. Like, look at this thing. So... It's a keyboard, Chiclet keys, looks about the size of, so like 9 inches square maybe, and it folds up into a CRT, sort of like an Osborne or something, but the whole thing folds up, not just the keyboard. The form factor I thought was just super interesting. I think it's a really beautiful looking device, and so that was really what caught my eye. But yeah, there's a write-up here about tearing into it and seeing how it works, and you know, what the protocol for Minitel was and how it crammed, you know, data into wasted space in the, on the phone lines and so on. So kind of a neat write-up, but yeah, I just wanted to have everyone look at this beautiful device.
look upon it.
And because it's French market only hardware, everything on it is French, which I love. So the space bar says Espace on it, which also makes me happy.
I had to look down and go, like, I'm not used to space bars. Yeah, okay, mine has nothing. I'm like, why are they even labeling this space bar?
They're not usually
just
labeled.
Just to show off that it's French. We want to make sure you know this is French. Pick a key and label it.
Yeah,
it is interesting that they labeled it.
This bar intentionally left not blank.
I wonder if that's if there's a, I don't know, a UX moment there where they had to explain, like they had to label the key because you wouldn't know what it was otherwise. But I mean, typewriters had space bars, but maybe because the keyboard format is different enough from a typewriter that people might not necessarily know that the big blank thing at the bottom is the space bar. I don't know.
And what is the name of that? I have a game console. It was actually sort of a poor game console. I'm blanking on the name of it. But anyway, it had a space bar that was like the size of a regular button.
Oh
goodness!
So very
because we hate you.
Yeah.
There was. I mean, a lot of the handheld computers were like that. Like I had the Radio Shack, the little PC 101 or whatever. That little It looks like a scientific calculator, but it was a tiny little computer with a terrible BASIC in it. And yeah, the space bar was a regular key, so it was just a key that said space on it.
Yeah.
Space, you need more of it.
Mattel Aquarius was the thing I was trying to remember.
That's good. There you go.
Over here.
There you go.
Space button. Right underneath the shift key.
That is terrible.
Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, Aquarius. What were you doing?
It was not the age of you.
No.
It was not.
All right. Anyway. Okay. So we've made it through our items of interest and news, primarily provided by Quinn. Thank you.
Thank you for rescuing us.
Yes. And now, a word from our sponsor.
It's time for school again. Time for young people all over America to start back to school and college.
Say, would you stop them for a minute, please? Thank you. You see, before they go back, I'd like every parent to read this. Students who use typewriters get up to 38% better grades. Now, that's a fact proved by tests. And it isn't hard to understand when you see a typewriter like the new Remington QuietWriter. It's the only portable with all these features to make homework go faster. This exclusive miracle tab, wonderful for making lists. It sets and clears tabulator stops right from the keyboard. No fumbling behind the machine. Yes, students really do themselves proud on the QuietWriter. The standard keyboard with its swift-moving keys gives book reports and themes a truly professional look. So give the students in your home a chance to get better grades, up to 38% better grades. Give them the Remington QuietWriter.
Throughout the world, more Remington typewriters are sold than any other make. Remington portables are priced from $74.50 to $113.50, only a dollar a week. After a small down payment.
And we're back. All right, and so now is time for the host's retro computing gift idea. Carrington has located the coloring book of retro computers, which I think is pretty cool. This is from the RMC store.
Why would you want this, though, is the big question. So yes, so it is a coloring book you can pick up for $12, including VAT, or $10 if you're outside of the area, so don't have to pay tax.
Where buck is... pound.
By buck, I mean pound. By pound, I mean euro. By euro, I mean all currency is the same. Whatever. You can pay in NFTs. So it is a coloring book of retro computers. I don't know what else to put this. The weirdest thing is, like, it seems like these wouldn't necessarily be great things to be coloring, but it's right in our wheelhouse. So if you have Apple computers, and you could just pick how yellow you want to color them in, I guess.
Yeah, so I had as a pairing to this orange highlighters. that you could also use to get the 2022 colors correct.
If you want to get them really accurate, what you should do
Here's
is
a,
color
a Vectrex
them,
that you can color black.
But slightly yellow them, and then in black marker, you write on like a school ID number thing that's or has been burned right. in the side. Like you can make these things like they actually appear on eBay. Yeah. But it is a coloring book of retro computers. I'm surprised it exists, but it does. And you can buy it for your retro computer fan for a holiday.
Very cool. Now I think we are at the point where we can move to the eBay auctions. And Carrington has the first of these.
Oh, then okay, I will open that up. So what I did was I picked a couple of things on a theme. I couldn't find anything that I would recommend that Paul buy, and I basically pick my things by what should Paul buy. So instead, I just decided to go with a couple of themes, something indicative of the 80s, something indicative of the 90s. Indicative of the 80s, and also it's the ridiculousness of both eras. For the 80s, I am picking the retro computer bug. So it is a bug. It is a chip with googly eyes on it, and I remember this sort of ridiculous thing you would get.
Yeah.
So this is a little plastic box, and it's got a real computer chip even inside. It says it's a real computer chip. Dude, it says on the back. No, dude, exactly as they do it. So it's the 80s. It's a thing. It's cheap. It's $15. And I think it's indicative of something ridiculous from the 80s. It doesn't get brought up much. You don't see it. Like people do computer shows set in the 80s, and they'll have vintage computers, and they'll have the poster of War Games and stuff, but they don't have these kind of tchotchkes that I remember being all over the place.
Yeah. The schlock that was in every novelty gift store like this. Right? It was everywhere.
And so it's $15 to buy it now. Is it worth it? No, it wasn't worth it then, but it is very much indicative of a chunk of the 80s that I remember that doesn't get talked about that much. So 1984 computer bug, a pet bug, pet rock equivalent, but for the 1980s, it's a googly eyes on an IC. So that's what you get for $15 nowadays. $15 and that'll buy you a cup of coffee, as they say.
This is the kind of stuff that like your aunt would give you.
Yeah, it's that's what I was thinking.
Oh, it's you like computers, right? And they'd be in the gift shop and they'd be like, oh,
this was funny. Using a very 1970s, but it's computer bug in a great font. I do like the font very much. It screams the world control. This is Colossus. So it's the friendly computer bug. So that's my first one. My second choice is from Micron PC. Now, the Micron PC came out in 1994, 95, something like that, got a big IPO, and by 2001 was gone. Got bought up by another company, then just disappeared. So it's part of the 1990s tech big bubble where they got tons of VC capital. And what did they do with it? They made things like this, juggling balls in a can. Because of course they did. It's a new computer. Let's put it out with juggling balls in a can. So this is it's like a tennis ball canister with a pop top. It has not been pulled. It's got the old fashioned ring kind. It's gonna yank off. And this looks like it stays connected to the can. So that's good. $27.55, weirdly specific, buy it now in US. And it is literally juggling balls in a can. There's an open one here, so you can see the kind of balls you get. They are branded Micron PC hack balls. So in the 1990s, if you listened to a lot of grunge, you would wear plaid and you would play hacky sack and be high as heck on computer campuses. And Micron PC was clearly trying to tap into that market. And this is why within 6 years, they had gone bust. So you can tap into that 1990s nostalgia. For $27.55, get yourself a can of three juggling balls. This is what Paul should buy this week. This is what I say.
You know, and if you look at this, one of the photos on this, I think it may be the second one, is this in context on a shelf, clearly at like Goodwill or the Salvation Army or something like that. You know, there's like, I think another one, you know, shows it next to a Frozen box or something. So it's, you know, it's clearly like this is somebody found some funny thing in a store and they're going to put it on eBay.
Yes.
And the artwork on the can is just the worst kind of like corporate promotional schlock, like
time energy,
resources, like the metaphor for juggling. Like, oh my God, shut up.
Right. So every decade has things that are terrible in computers. And this is the 1990s. And you're welcome to it. So those are my choices.
Fantastic.
That's the best of eBay this week. What do you got to compete with my Micron PC juggling balls?
It's a tough act to follow.
I did the thing. I thought, well, okay, I'm kind of curious to see what happens if I do this. You know, people make this joke about, like, Steve Jobs Rare on listings. And so I thought I would search for Steve Jobs Rare. And so I found a few things that came up with that. One of the things that I thought was kind of an interesting small pattern of things is signed photographs by people near Steve Jobs. So here's Steve Wozniak, signed photo of him near Steve Jobs. And here's Tim Cook, signed near Steve Jobs. I was thinking it's kind of like, you get your photo by the Eiffel Tower or whatever. You know, sort of like.
Dear Steve Jobs. Well, and they're all funny because Steve Jobs never signed anything. Right. But like Steve Wozniak will sign anything. So
this is a Tim Cook one. So Tim Cook says, I'm currently running Apple. Been running it for years. I made it the most valuable company ever in the existence of the universe. And you don't, and it's just like, this is good because you're near Steve Jobs.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, it's not, I think in neither case, is it the person whose signature, yeah, I mean, these are like signature companies, you know, they yeah. go and get autographs and then they sell them to people at, you know, 4-digit costs.
Well, and that doesn't look like Steve Wozniak's signature, actually. Like that's, he signs everything Woz, doesn't he?
Woz, right? Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Although, like, I've never seen him write out like that.
Yeah, although the Woz part of Wozniak does look
right. Woz does look right, yeah.
But anyway, all of these are, you know, $1,300, $1,000 items, but I thought it was sort of funny. This one came up. I want to be a heavy equipment operator. Steve Poole Rare. And, you know, I just thought it was kind of funny. It's a VHS, you know.
Is it signed by Steve Woz?
It is. It has. I couldn't figure out
he
actually
would sign
what,
it.
What, you know, like I thought maybe okay, well maybe it's about Jobs and it has Steve and Rare in it or something. But no, actually, if you go down to the listing, it says actor Steve Jobs. So somebody made a mistake when they put in the details on this, and Steve Jobs is actually listed in the item specifics.
Or maybe he's in it. How old is this thing? Maybe this is little young Steve Jobs.
1995.
Yeah. Probably not then.
See heavy machinery in action for any age.
If this was after he was kicked out of Apple and before he went to Next and he wasn't sure what he was going to do, this could be the most valuable thing you've ever found. He was like, maybe I want to be a heavy equipment operator. They interview him. What do you think? I got nothing else to do. Let's try it. It's him in a helmet. Oh, yeah. I'm not going to sign this.
Telling everyone what they're doing wrong.
Yeah. Okay. So then, you know, thematically, I thought I would look for things. So this is a T-shirt, a Stuffit T-shirt.
That's a terrible Aladdin Crew logo. Wow.
Yeah.
That is terrible.
Just Stuffit World Tour.
Yeah. I don't miss those 90s neon everything logos. Those were not good.
Yeah. I don't understand what the Just Stuffit World Tour is. It actually lists some cities.
Yeah, it could be cities that opened in, or it could be that it was like a trade show tour. Like maybe that was cities that were having an equivalent of a Comdex type thing.
Maybe that's what it is. Yeah, because I've seen – so this actually was in the Raymond Lau era. This was before it turned terrible. so we're allowed to think positively about this shirt. And I saw some reference to it in Tidbits. You know, like you could still – like there was some – promotional deal where you could buy Stuffit Deluxe and it would come with one of the Stuffit World Tour shirts. So anyway, if you were very late to the game and want one now, there's a $75 buy it now. I think there's a defect in this. There's a pinhole. But
the best
otherwise.
Thing, of course, would be if it's a large shirt, but it got washed and shrunk, yeah, and that's that like the thing. Yeah. And it'd be like, well, of course it's small.
Then you got to stuff yourself into it because it's too small.
That's right. Yeah. Whatever. Here's Auto Doubler. $5, buy it now.
Oh, Auto Doubler. Oh, jeez.
So that must be by the same company as Disc Doubler, because that is like full-on Disc Doubler look. Oh, yeah. From the makers of Disc Doubler. Okay, there you go. Because I'm like, that is what it looked like.
Yeah, it was the successor. Yeah. Yeah.
I think Disc Doubler, I don't quite remember this, but I think it was that Disc Doubler required a manual step. Like, say, I'm going to make this file be small, and whenever I want to use it, it will expand itself or something. I don't know. I mean,
an auto-doubler just says, I'm taking over.
Yeah, I guess.
Auto-doubler was magical. I remember that. Like, you just turned it on, and you just got disk space back. Like, it was, it actually did work really well, but yeah, it was terrifying.
I remember being so dubious when I first heard about RAM doubler and disk doubler and not understanding any of the technology behind it. I was like, nope. Nope, yeah, totally
that
fake.
That can't possibly
can't
work.
You can't. Yeah. I can't run a thing and then I've got more RAM than you're. What? Yeah. That's magic. That's not. I was so absolutely convinced it was not a thing that could be real.
Yeah.
And then like 2 years later, I'm like, well, everything has virtual memory, of course. I'm just paging out the disk. Whatever. I knew about that all the time.
I didn't believe in the hard drive compression things until like two or three of my PC friends were using it. The big PC one that went around. I don't remember what it was called, but. Yeah, they were all using it for a long time, and it was fine. So that was what finally convinced me to try it. But.
It did seem like magic to me at first, though. My mind was blown by that stuff.
That's going to bug me now. If someone is on the stream, please tell me, Stacker, thank you. Oh, my gosh. Yes, that was the name I was trying to come up with. Thank you, Christopher.
Well done,
C.
Christopher.
You have no idea the good you've done today for my brain.
Fantastic. And you know, staying on the theme, if you wanted to get PKZIP version 2.70 for Windows, here is a sealed copy.
Wow. It's one of those things I didn't know came in a box. It was just this thing everyone had installed. It was just PKZIP. Everyone had it. But yeah, that was definitely one of those software packages that, like, the ratio of people who bought it to people who use it must have been like 0.1%, because... Yeah. Everybody used it, and I didn't even know it was a box. I think I thought it was shareware or something. Like,
I think it started as shareware.
It must have started.
Maybe
as
it started it. Yeah.
All I know is I never paid for it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I know that as well. Actually, I remember being fairly surprised not that long ago. Maybe it's still even true because I don't really use Windows, but you know that Windows doesn't, or it didn't, you know, have a ZIP technology built in. You had to go out and find, you know, one of 400 identical looking ZIP programs and try to guess which is the one that isn't malware.
Yeah. and which is that. Like the standard one that everyone uses, because that's the one you want, is whatever one everyone else is using. Yeah. I remember that about for a while. I think that was kind of what PKZIP did, was it kind of solved, it's kind of standardized everything. Because, yeah, there was a period there where there was 10 different ZIPs and you didn't know which one to use.
Okay. I think the last one I will mention is this. This is the Multiputer. I don't know anything about it, but I just thought it looked very nice. It is a 1970 computational skills trainer system math computer, it says. I don't even know if it works, but it has a keypad and knobs and a slightly frayed power cord.
What do the knobs say?
The knobs say number group, mode, and number of problems.
Huh.
Number of problems. I would like as few problems, but we can only go down as few as 10 problems.
Yeah. Why didn't that go to zero? I want no problems.
I think it must. Yeah. So this must be an educational. Yeah. Some sort of like educational thing. But it really just looks like a thing with a face.
So it has a sticker on it that says purchased with federal funds.
Yep.
I think it said what was that a thing?
Cape Girardeau. So whose federal is this? Cape Girardeau. Is it
sounds
US?
Canadian. Cape Girardeau. Title One. Public schools. But that, I mean, it would say something or other of Canada. It wouldn't just say federal funds.
And there's no way it wouldn't also be in French.
Yeah. That's right. So maybe, I don't know.
It says do not remove from the premises, or at least you can see that it used to say that, but a little bit of the do was removed, and so maybe that makes it okay.
Oh, not removed from premises.
Yeah, it's like the beginning of Oh Canada, right?
Oh, Cape Girardeau is in Missouri.
Okay. So anyway, it's an interesting looking little thing. It's funny though. They have not picked the angle that I want. I want to see this from sort of like a slightly turned view, and you can see it from just
they're
the front.
Saying if you'd like
just
that,
the back.
You can purchase it.
Yeah.
From the back, it makes it look like it has horns. It looks like a little devil.
Is it a half sphere? And I want the bottom to remove and cover the top so that it becomes a sphere when it's stowed.
Yeah, or bowl with it.
Or bowl with it.
Except for the keyboard, I guess. I'd sort of bump over that. But
well, it adds an element of chance to your bowling game.
Important. That's why there's at least 10 problems, and they are the buttons on the front when you try to bowl. Actually, technically 11 problems, but okay.
All right. Okay. Anyway, I think that is those are the things that I found. I didn't say how much this was. If you wanted to get the multi-pewter, the only one on eBay, you can start. The bidding starts at $49.03.
Why 3 cents? Where's this based?
It is.
Is that like a conversion thing, or is it? Oh, so they just picked that number. So what does 49.03 mean? Is it a chip in there or something? What if that's a meaningful starting bid?
It does seem like it must be meaningful to somebody, but don't know. Does not say. Has not been tested for parts only. I would actually kind of like to see. It looks like there is a display, and it seems like it should display something if it is turned on. It also looks like it might catch fire if you plug it in, but...
It would be nice to know what the display looks like. I'm assuming it's like red LED segments or something.
Yeah.
That's what I'm assuming too.
Anyway, okay. So I will leave my eBay auctions there. That's good. I think we have made it through. Welcome to closing discussions. Carrington, do you have any closing thoughts?
In retro stuff, I finally have a fully working... I've been working on a text adventure, and it's finally essentially done in that it all works. You can go through it, and I have all the scoring done and such. I've been working on the feelies to go with it. And so that's exciting. Going to go to beta soon. There's so much more I wish I could put in it, but I've hit the limit of the size of the stupid language I picked. So, but my target is to release as an Apple II game. So this is as much. So everything I add now, I have to keep taking things out. So that's been the pain, hitting the 128K limit. But... it's exciting to finally be at that stage where it's fully playable and getting beta feedback. So that's fun. So get that going. I got that going for me.
Nice. And I might mention that just in the feedback, we have, now I've lost my window here, but that, what was the thing I just had up?
Oh,
the
multi-pewter.
Look at this.
Multi-pewter. The math pewter is quite similar. It appears to be the same basic system, except in a much less cool looking. This looks like, more like the what's the guy from Battlestar Galactica?
Beady, beady, beady.
That guy.
Dr. Theopolis. Yeah. Wasn't that the one that hung around his neck as if he was like the Flavor Flav of the 24th century? Yeah.
Yeah. But this also seems to be a thing that goes down to 10 problems.
Okay, nice. So that was from Will Scullin in the chat. Thank you, Will.
Yeah.
I think this one actually looks cooler. Like the
Twiggy,
components
Jeremy,
look
thank you.
Better quality, honestly.
Yeah. So, still from Cybernetic Systems, Inc. So, yeah. Anyway, if you want both.
Math
see, this one is $40.
Doesn't roll off the tongue, though.
Neither does multi-pewter, though. Multi-pewter sounds like, I don't know, something you
both
mix
with concrete.
Both of
them sound like you're getting sick.
Yeah, exactly. They both sound like
I'm completely multi-pewtered.
All right. Let's see. Am I next? I don't know.
Sure.
I've been scanning things. I've been always... That's the same thing I've always been saying. One thing that I did discover...
We still believe you.
I have a scanner, and I've been scanning discs and stuff like that. And one of the discs I have is... it's from a fairly small group of Simulations Canada. And so their disc, they put their disc label, this particular one was called Gray Seas, Gray Skies, I think it was called. And their
Canada.
Disc label, yeah, it's some sort of naval battle thing. And the disc label is fluorescent orange. So it's you hold up the disc. I could probably even go get the disc, but I mean, like, you hold up the disc and it's very orange. Maybe I will go get the disc. 1 second.
Get that disc. So Simulations Canada. Quinn, do you think that is simulating Canada? Like, let's do Winnipeg.
Yeah, that'd be a short simulation. It's cold and there's
just
nothing to do.
Just saw this says leave. There's a lot of mosquitoes.
We don't even have a hockey team anymore.
I know, poor
right,
Winnipeg.
Here we are.
Here you are.
This is it. Gray Seas, Gray Skies.
I have never heard of that. I've never heard of Simulations Canada. This is all new to me.
Okay. So can you see this? Seems pretty orange, right?
Seems pretty orange.
Pretty orange.
Turns out that my scanner cannot see fluorescent colors. So when I scan it, it's gray.
Okay.
Which, of course, since it's Gray Seas, Gray Skies, I figured my scanner was attempting to make a joke. But it is very strange that it is.
It's all fluorescent colors or just fluorescent orange?
I think it's Yeah, so this is how it comes out.
Oh, weird.
And it's just because the light reflected by a fluorescent color, the scanner doesn't pick it up or whatever.
That's interesting.
So bizarre.
So these don't look at all the same, do they?
No.
It is the same object, but it's just very frustrating. So that's one thing I learned, is that scanners don't do fluorescent colors, and now I'm worried about all the things I'm going to scan.
It's like one of those red things where you have a bunch of dots and you hold up the red filter, and like you can make secret messages that only your scanner can reveal.
Yeah, that's true. Huh?
Yeah. It does seem like it could be a thing for protecting invisiclues or whatever, you know, in some way.
Yeah. But, speaking of which, I went down a rep because I'm working on the feelies for my game. I went through so many hoops trying to be able to make an invisiclues thing, and it's not going to happen. So that ink to get that printing that gets revealed, it's just nobody wants to tell you how to do it. There's like two companies that print that kind of thing, and they won't deal with anybody if you don't want to place an order for 700 million. I'm like, my game target is like 50 people. It's like, and even if I'm like Infocom and more people want the invisiclues than want the game for some reason, I'm going to need 20 copies of this. Like, it's just, so it just can't be done. Very, very disappointing. So,
does anyone know what that technology was that was, again, everywhere in the 70s and 80s where it was like a highlighter, but the ink was sort of faint yellow, but then you would wipe it over an area and it would show like very legible gray text.
Yeah.
That was super neat.
Yeah. And that's what I'm trying to do and try to get it, but it just, you can't get that made. And so I found a couple of companies that still do the printing for like those yes and no books and things in the States. Yeah. So I found them, I've talked to them directly, and just like, it just can't be done. I have tried, I've tried everything to get somebody to give me this kind of printing or tell me how it's done or whatever, and people just won't cough it up. So.
That's too bad. Yeah, that was everywhere, like game books, puzzle books, like that whatever that technology is, it was super ubiquitous. And if you buy them on eBay, the pens are all dried out, so it doesn't work.
But I do remember that. Josh in the chat says, I remember a chemistry set where you made that ink.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you can make ink that gets revealed. And so I looked at that even. Like, I looked at, because you can print, the closest I've come is you can print invisible ink that'll get revealed under UV light. And you can buy that to put in an inkjet printer. And you can actually literally print that stuff out. So that's kind of cool. But that's not the same as I wanted the yes and no pen revealing stuff. And so I tried to look for the bookmark. I can't find it. But I found the name of the type of printing it's called. And so you do this dye printing that has this particular chemical, and it's called something in the industry, and just a few people do it, and just you can't do it yourself. You can't buy the stuff. Can't get anyone to do it for you. It's just not good. The yes and no books are just simply no, not for you. It's all guys no.
That's too bad. Those were neat. I like those things.
Mm-hmm. But it is going to be cool when your thing finally comes out. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, it's going to be neat. The feelies are really good. Paul got to see a preview of those, and like there's some cool stuff that comes with it. Whether the game's any good, I don't know. But there's some cool things that come with the game, so that's fun. So. Mm. And Paul can't scan orange.
Yes. Yeah, right, exactly. That's so weird. I had never come across this before, but now I'm kind of paranoid that I am going to be unable to reproduce some of these things. You know,
like how many things did you scan before that you didn't notice little bits that dropped out because it was too bright a yellow or something?
It's funny because I have on the photocopier at work, I scanned a bunch of things, you know, long ago, and I know I have scanned like some of these things on that. So it's not all scanners that do this. But apparently this particular one.
I have never encountered that before, like a scanner that won't do that. Oh, is there any chance it's a built-in thing like photocopiers can't do money and because it the hologram or whatever? And is it something like that that's triggering
it? Yeah, security thing maybe.
That was one of the hypotheses that came up.
Oh, but then it shouldn't scan it at all.
Yeah, I think usually if there's a certain like configuration of dots or something that will often make a scanner just say nope, or it will provide you, instead of the image it scanned, it will provide you with an image that says you can't copy money.
Right.
Yeah. Or I've seen them where it just puts a black rectangle over like the illegal to scan areas or whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Huh.
But I suppose it's possible. But I have seen, you know, out there on the internet, you know, message boards with people saying, "My art, you know, I use fluorescence in my art, and it's what kind of scanner can I buy? Because this isn't working."
Oh, okay.
What's surprising to me is that it comes out white, in the scan, because like I would expect it to come out
that color,
like dark gray or something.
I 100% would have thought the same thing, that it's overloading it and it would be like look almost black.
But it's like in a universe where that color doesn't exist, which is super strange failure mode. Because like the
and it's not white either. You can see like there's gray. Like it has scanned something. If you look at the one label, it's white and it's not white. It's gray. So it's really like strange.
The old game manuals that used copy protection, they would use like brown on yellow or whatever ink for the like copy protection portion of the manual, so you couldn't photocopy it, and it would just come out like a solid block of dark gray if you tried to photocopy it. But this is just like a totally different failure mode that is super weird.
Yeah, that is weird. Way to go, Paul.
Yeah, interesting.
You broke scanning.
Okay, so Quinn, any closing thoughts?
Yes, I've been working a little bit on my 2GS game again, because I've been doing some air travel, which is apparently required. The only time I can work on this thing is apparently when I'm forced to sit in an aluminum tube full of COVID for several hours. And so I have been doing more and more of that lately for travel. So yeah, I got a little bit more done on it. It's funny you mentioned, Carrington, you get to that 128K limit and then like the problem changes. Well, I kind of hit that same moment on mine where, so on the 2GS, the memory is divided up into 64K banks, and filling those banks is one of the primary challenges. Like there's plenty of space, like there's tons of space, but you have to like load the data and the code off of disk to put in all of that space. And so I wrote a very, very naive loader to start with, and it was, you know, sufficient for 5 years of development. Like it would only load like, I think a 40K block or something at a time, because that was how much buffer I had in bank zero, because it runs on Protoss 8. And so I load everything into a buffer there and then copy it into the right banks, and that was fine. But now I have like 41K of code. I hit the limit of my primitive loader, so now I have to like go and write a smarter loader. And so that's hit another wall there, but working on that now. So
gotta book some flights.
Yeah. Well, and the problem with the way, exactly. The problem with the way I'm doing this is because I only work on it once every 2.5 years, is that I forget everything that I used to know about 2GS development. So I gotta relearn everything and remember all the mistakes I always make.
You can't book any direct flights then. You gotta book like a short hop, and that's where you're gonna remind yourself of the code, and then there's the long haul where you're actually
Exactly. Well, in assembly code, like assembly language programming is like, it takes a lot of concentration, and you got to really be watching for the stupid mistakes all the time, right? Like the off by ones, and use the wrong kind of branch, or you forget to check, you forget to clear the carry before you do an add. You know, it's all these little things that get you. And if you're out of the mindset of doing it, you forget all those little things that you always got to be watching for. And then you make all those mistakes again. So next time you start working on it, your progress is really slow again for a while, because you start making all the stupid mistakes again, and you spend an hour trying to debug a bug that was because you forgot to clear the carry before you did an add, and all those sorts of things. So yeah, it's a little frustrating to come back to it after a long break, because you lose track of all that stuff. But I will say I've been a long proponent of using Git for retro development, and that's what saves me on projects like this, because I can look at my last, you know, 5 commits, even though it's just it's a local repo. Even if you're not using GitHub, I can just look at my last 5 commits and say, oh, okay, this is what I was working on, and this is how far I got with it, and I can pick that up where I left off. Because otherwise you spend 6 hours just trying to figure out what you were doing when you stopped 2 months ago, kind of thing. But yeah, so progress is being made though. I might have something first playable by next in-person K-Fest. That's kind of my goal now, but we'll see.
That could be 15 years from now.
So plenty of time. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, I must have mentioned this having happened to me before, but I will mention it again, that there was a time when I was in graduate school where there was a conference or something that I was going to in San Diego. So I flew to San Diego and then sort of like, it must have been kind of like, anyway, after I'd set that up, there was some other conference I needed to go to, and it was in Winnipeg, and it was basically the same time. So I set up, because, you know, so I already had this round trip from Boston to San Diego, and so I set up a round trip from San Diego to Winnipeg. And what ended up happening was that, you know, that all made perfect sense, except the ridiculous thing was that they were all two-step journeys that, you know, transferred in Minneapolis.
Chicago or Minneapolis, okay.
So There was a chunk of this time, and it was impossible to get out of this because it would wind up canceling parts of trips or whatever. So there was a chunk of this time when I was standing in Minneapolis, and I had to fly to San Diego so that I could stand in Minneapolis again so that I could get home. there was like 0 point of my taking this trip to San Diego, but I had to do it or else my return trip would get canceled. So anyway, that's the kind of situation where that might be good for.
You're flying on Kafka Airlines.
Yeah. Well, air travel is great for retro development because, like, you have no internet and you want to conserve battery, and the emulators don't take a lot of horsepower, so you know it's not like watching video or playing a modern game where it's going to eat up your battery. So it's all kind of a good fit for something you can work on locally for a long period of time.
More fun if you don't use an emulator though. You want to do retro development on big old
an actual 2C.
Right.
Yeah, it doesn't fit in the overhead.
As far as beside
so
you,
well.
Can I put a printer on your tray?
Could you hold this image writer? It was free.
I just imagine the tractor feed paper going over the seat in front of you onto the person. What is all that?
I wonder how loud a dot matrix printer would be in an airplane, though. That would be...
Probably be pretty, although airplanes loud. By themselves are pretty loud. They're surprisingly loud.
Yeah, but a modem sound can cut through a lot of other noise.
It's true.
And some people will know exactly what it is, and other people are going to panic.
It's the evil hacker noise from TV. I remember.
I wonder if the flight attendant would ask if your Apple II was in airplane mode. Like, I think
always.
That's the only mode it has.
Yeah. That's right. It is funny. I mean, like, I think we've remarked on this before, but the weird isolation you feel on something like an Apple II that is not connected to anything. It's like, like, I don't remember feeling isolated before, but now it feels weird that this can't talk to anything else. All right. Anyway. Okay. I think we've made it.
We did it.
So, congratulations on everyone managing to show up at some time, at least.
Eventually.
So that is it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can also watch the show on YouTube, where dancing happens at the end. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. Please write a review on iTunes if you wish. And until next time,
Retro Compute!
Good evening, everyone. This is Walter Cronkite speaking to you from CBS Television Election Headquarters here in New York City.